You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are, and this is all your fault. I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so I don't
decide. Alright, now I don't want anybody to think that I'm selfish for doing this interview, but this next interview might be a little bit selfish. Joining me very graciously, somebody I read about and have been reading about is Ann Germain. So, Ann, first of all, welcome to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Mac. Pleasure.
All right, before we talk about what you do, we have to learn about you so we can decide, we can judge you to see if we can believe you or not. Okay, so born and raised where?
In Canada, close to Quebec City.
What? Not only are you not American, but you're Canadian. Not only are you not Canadian, you're a Quebecer, eh?
I am, eh? And I, so if you detect a slight accent, it's my French-Canadian accent that will come through.
Oh, good Lord. All right. So you're born and raised there. Where do you go to university? What did you want to do when you were a kid?
I went to school, my undergrad at McGill University, and then went to the University of Montreal for my PhD in clinical psychology. And while I was at McGill is when I was introduced to sleep research, and I haven't stopped since then. I continued to do sleep research and train in clinical behavioral sleep medicine during my doctoral training, and then moved to the United States in Pennsylvania to do my postdoctoral training here, so specialty, again, in learning more about how to design strong clinical studies, but also to expand my training in sleep neuroscience, and eventually joined the faculty at the University of Pittsburgh, where I'm currently a professor of psychiatry there, but I'm on leave because the past year and a half, we started this startup company basically to expand what we did in the research and the lab setting outside into the real world to try to reach more veteran service members and civilians who have sleep difficulties.
So would you say you're a geek? Because that sounds like a relatively geeky little resume you just read right there.
That I am a sleep geek, yes.
All right, you combine it to being sleep. So, and also, could you educate everybody on the correct pronunciation of the city, Montreal, as we would say it? But whenever I watch Hockey Night in Canada, and they refer to the Montreal Canadiens, it is not Montreal, it is Montreal.
Montreal, yes.
Oh, you didn't have to go French on us. Actually, I will tell you this. I've only been to Montreal once, and it is a beautiful, wonderful city. And the old part of the city, the restaurants there, it's what a beautiful place, yes?
Well, I'm glad you had a great experience. Actually, Montreal is home to me now. I've moved away from Quebec City for school, and then to Montreal to go to McGill, and the rest of my family also moved to Montreal. So Montreal is what I consider home now in Canada. In the U.S., it's really Pittsburgh is home.
Oh, my God. How do you live with the disparity between, I mean, come on, Pittsburgh, really?
Oh,
whoa.
You haven't been to Pittsburgh, have you?
No, never. Are you going to sell me Pittsburgh now?
I can sell you Pittsburgh. It actually, I describe it as one of the best-kept secrets in the United States. For one, when I first came to Pittsburgh, I expected to see a gray city, an old industrial city. And it may have been true before, but I came in 2001 to Pittsburgh, and since then it's changed a lot. And before then, it's a very green city, very biking friendly.
Really?
The food scene is amazing. The cultural scene is growing every year. I strongly recommend a visit to Pittsburgh. I can guarantee that if you haven't been, you will be pleasantly surprised, and you'll want to come back.
Good Lord. I form my opinion largely on the behavior of Steelers fans between, like, when things happen. And that culturally doesn't reflect well in the community. I just want you to know that, you know, that a lot of masks, a lot of crazy helmets and other stuff, and a lot of odd behavior. So that's how I mostly form my opinion. But I will say this, the baseball stadium, extremely picturesque in downtown Pittsburgh. It's beautiful when they show that on TV. So being a sports fan, I want to say that the baseball stadium is changing my very, very low opinion I had watched based on Pittsburgh Steelers football.
Oh, yes. And both, I mean, the baseball stadium and the football stadium are worth a visit. Just the view that they have on the city, the downtown skyline is amazing from both of these places.
All right. So let's talk about insomnia. Now that I've found, even though you're a little geeky, all right, you've acquitted yourself well so far.
Thank you.
Neither I nor my friends sleep through the night. And on occasion, we have these 3:30 in the morning discussions that we do because, you know, at any given time, somebody will be awake because we sleeping through the night is like a quaint notion to us. Mm-hmm. So talk to me, first of all, what is insomnia, right? Or do we have insomnia? Is it something else? So can you explain what insomnia is, and then can you talk about why is, I would say, the veteran community and the first responder community so profoundly impacted by it?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So insomnia is generally defined as the difficulty falling asleep, or this general feeling of even if you sleep, that your sleep is not restful, and that's accompanied by daytime consequences of not sleeping well, so having problems with concentration or memory or having a short fuse, maybe mood swings during the day, having some bodily pains that may be related to sleeping poorly. So that's a general definition of insomnia. I'll say right off the bat that the estimates that we have from either active duty service members and veterans show that the prevalence of insomnia is much higher in people who serve or have served than it is found in the general civilian population. So among veterans and service members, the estimates can be as high as 40%. Whereas the general population, it's typically around 10% of the population that suffers from insomnia. And the reasons why, I think you would know better than I do, what we find is that, you know, there's a number of service-related factors that kind of prime somebody to be more susceptible for insomnia. So it doesn't matter if you're in garrison or deployed, that the operational tempo is very high. Oftentimes people have a shortened episode or opportunity for sleep because they have to travel to base, to work, in the morning, and they have to commute, so they have to get up early to take care of the family business and then leave for work to be there on time. By the time they come home, they have a lot to do. They don't necessarily have time to wind down before they go to sleep, so when the bedtime comes around, their mind stays very active. So even if they want to try to fall asleep, they can, and during the night, they may be restless. So even at home, back home in garrison, people have like the operational tempo or training exercises can contribute to disrupting sleep, basically preventing sleep onset or preventing this winding down that is necessary before we're able to fall asleep. Of course, when people are deployed on different missions, then again, you know better than I do that the operational tempo can be very high. The stressors are multiple. There's certainly traumatic experiences that can happen, and that is actually the reduced opportunity for sleep is obvious and oftentimes necessary under these conditions. The problem is that when people come home or after these operations or these missions, It's not like the switch goes off and people go back to sleeping the same way they used to sleep before, or just as well as they did before if they didn't have already have a sleep problem. Sleep is actually it's hardwired in your brain, but it entrains, adapts to our environment. But sometimes we develop patterns of sleeping that require that we can, I've heard so many times people saying that they can sleep with one eye open, and that to me reflects the kind of level of alertness and vigilance that people need to maintain under different circumstances. But this becomes a habit of not being able to sleep very restfully or achieve deep restorative sleep, because their brain keeps monitoring the environment in case something happens and in case they need to react quickly. So it's a habit that the brain can take and keep even when people are back home. And breaking this habit is feasible. It's certainly possible, but it rarely, for some people, it happens on its own. For a lot of people, though, they need to get specific treatments or changing their behaviors to teach their brains to sleep in a restorative way like they did before they deployed or were assigned to different missions.
So walk me through traditional treatment for insomnia. Right, because here's what I do, and I've done this in Iraq and Afghanistan. I developed this technique where I would lay in bed and I couldn't go to sleep, or a lot of times I can go to sleep, but not for very long. And then when I wake up, and once, I didn't really tell you this, but I'm like gifted intellectually. So once the nuclear reactor goes off, right, I'm like, might as well get up because I'm not going back to sleep, right? Because when there's that much like gray matter all energized at one time, I mean, good God, exactly, right? You know, well, you would know what I'm talking about, being a geek and all. So I had this technique where I would concentrate on the blackest part of my eyelids, right? Well, Mac, isn't your whole eyelid black? No, there's parts in my eyelid that are blacker than others, and I would concentrate on it. And that would work for me on occasion. And I don't know if I just think it did or it did, but how have historically, how has insomnia been treated? And let me caveat all of that by saying, we are averse to medications. I mean, one, you know, you walk in, nobody I know is not affected by trauma. And so, you know, so quickly people give you what we call the zombie cocktail, right? And anxiety and a depression. And we throw the drugs away. So when I saw that your work, you know, focuses on, you know, an approach that doesn't emphasize medications, I was very sympathetic. So talk to us about historically the way insomnia has been treated and then what you guys have kind of angled towards.
Okay. The first line treatment for insomnia, the one that is recommended by experts in sleep medicine, but also from the American College of Physicians, and both in the U.S. and Canada and in the U.K., as well as WHO, all recommend a treatment of insomnia that is not the first treatment of insomnia not being medication. That it typically it's called something that we call cognitive behavioral treatment for insomnia. And what really that means.
Whoa, I just want to tell you that you just pegged the dork meter went straight into the red lines. Say that again. Cognitive what?
Cognitive behavioral treatment of insomnia, or
whoa,
CBTI.
How old were you when you went on your first date? Like 36, I'm guessing. What? Wow. Okay. Keep going.
So, and actually, this is like the official term, but what it refers to is basically very specific technique to change our waking behavior in a way that influence the brain circuitry that controls sleep. Not just falling asleep, but staying asleep. So CBTI is actually, as I said, a different techniques. The two main techniques, the techniques that work the best, are one that is called stimulus control. And what that means is basically training your brain to reassociate or reinforce the association between your bed and your bedroom and the feeling of sleepiness and being asleep. Oftentimes, people who have insomnia do all sorts of things in their bed at night or before they go to sleep. So when you said earlier that sometimes you're talking with your friends at 3 o'clock in the morning, I actually put down a note to ask you, are you in bed when you're chatting? Are you in bed when you're talking on the phone? Because any kind of activities that we do in our bed or bedroom that is too activating from a brain perspective is actually weakening this association, and we're teaching our brain basically that our sleeping environment is not for sleep, but it could be for anything else.
I don't want to talk to them. Like, they talk to me, and I'm awake, so I answer. Like, a friend of mine was coming out here, and he said, I can't come have lunch because I've got to see my daughter, and I got to go to this, and then I'm not going to be able to. So I got that at 3:30 in the morning, and I was awake. And so I sent him a very derogatory kind of off-color comment, one-word comment, that had to do with a part of the male anatomy. And he then takes it back. He said, what are you doing awake? I said, who sleeps through the night? Hello? And he said, yeah, good point. So we're just awake. And so I'm hoping that I'm go back to sleep, right?
Yes. And so you stay, but so you're in bed and you respond to text messages or calls, or you do different things, or you think. And really, then your brain has learned over time that even though you want to sleep, and that's why you stay in bed even when you're awake, your brain is kind of losing this association that this is the place where you're supposed to be sleeping and feeling sleepy. So the very simple technique, the application of this technique is, I would say, look, if you're in bed and you're awake, get out of there. Go to your living room, not sleeping on the couch, not laying down on the couch, but go to the living room, sit up, go to the kitchen, go to the porch somewhere, and do your waking activity in the waking environment. And when you start feeling as sleepy again, then you go back to sleep. You go back to your bed. You go back to your bedroom.
Okay. Now hold on. I want to ask. I want to ask you one question about that. Now, I thought you were going to say your phone shouldn't be in your bedroom.
Oh, that too.
Okay, but I'm a father, right? I have a daughter 25 and a daughter 15 that will soon be 16. So I don't think not having my phone in case something happens, you know, to them when they're out in the evening. And I have to go get involved in some stuff. I don't think that I can't have my phone in my bedroom because I thought you would say that. So
fair point. So what you can do for situations like this that is very valid. A lot of phones now have this function where you can have a do not disturb function on your phone, but let through only phone numbers or text messages from important people. So if you say, if my daughters call in the middle of the night, of course I want to be able to hear the phone and pick up, and I want that call to come through or that text to come through. So you can set that up. You can actually set your do not disturb function in a way that only the absolute necessary or absolutely important calls or messages come through. And other things that you think, well, you know, if my friend calls to cancel lunch tomorrow, it's fine if I find out when I get up in the morning.
Right.
Then you screen out all of these other calls or numbers. And what it does then is that you can actually, your brain will learn that, you know, it's fine to fall asleep, and you can rely on your phone to pass the information that is absolutely critical, a phone call from your daughter, for example,
okay.
And that the information that is less time sensitive can wait until the morning. So then you can go to sleep knowing that what you need to know, you will know if something happens, and what is less important can wait until the morning and won't disrupt your sleep unless it's absolutely necessary.
Okay. Let me read you an email. Matt, first of all, thank you for having Dr. Germain on. After I heard you talk about it, I went and read the article in military.com. My question is, I have never had a class about sleep. This is the first I've ever really heard of it. I am a retired United States Army veteran. Why is this? You know what? I hadn't really thought about that, and I've never heard like what you're talking about. I've never had a class. When anything, now, I know you're a geek, so you'll get this, so I'm going to translate this for everybody else. But when you read that the percentage of people suffering from insomnia goes up 652%, okay, yep. For those of you that aren't statistically inclined, that's a lot, okay? And so one would think we would at least get some fundamental instruction about, hey, I can tell you almost with certainty that the majority of you are going to have sleep issues. Right, and let me just show you some techniques that you can use, and these are the basics. Why, you're a smart person, why have they not taught us that? Why have they not taught us anything about this?
For that, that's unfortunately common, and fortunately it's slowly changing. So for the longest time, and for all of you who served in the military, know that sleep was perceived as a waste of time, that, you know, sleep for the dead, you'll sleep later and no time for this, and that, you know, the unit that doesn't sleep is the unit that's going to win. All of this culture around and perception that sleep is not important, that because we're not acting while we're sleeping, sleep must be useless. Was the norm for a very long time, and it's still there, but it's fortunately slowly but surely changing. We know that sleep is absolutely necessary. It is a fundamental biological function. Your body needs sleep to repair muscle damage, to control infections, to regulate your immune system. Your brain desperately needs sleep to clear what needs to be clear, remember what needs to be remembered, make sense and integrate different kinds of experience, consolidate memory, consolidate new skills that people learn. So we know now that sleep is absolutely necessary, not just for mental health, but for physical health generally. And these scientific findings are making their way into the military. It is a pillar for readiness and for resilience, response to injury, whether it's physical or psychological injuries. So for the longest time, sleep was perceived as something that is useless, therefore if we can get rid of it, we'll all be better off. And now we know that it actually is much more damageable to try to get rid shorten sleep for extended period of time when there's no possibility for recovery. There is slowly, as I said, slowly but surely things are changing there. A few years ago, the Army actually put out their performance triad. So basically three areas of healthy behaviors that support health and readiness. And that included physical activity, nutrition, and sleep is one of these pillars. The class that you were describing, that actually would be an amazing goal if we could do this, is to have these kind of classes where you tell people, look, there's a fair chance that your sleep will be affected. You know you have a problem with sleep when X, Y, and Z occurs. If it takes you longer than 30 minutes to fall asleep, if you wake up multiple times a night and you're awake for more than 30 minutes at night, if you wake up and you're not rested and you feel like your sleep was very restless, this is a sign that you need to we need to intervene. You need to seek treatment. And again, not with medication, but realigning your behavior, retraining your brain to sleep in the way that is the most restorative as possible. And there's slowly, both on the operational side and on the medical side, this growing recognition that sleep is actually one of the force multiplier when it comes to human performance optimization, as well as recovery from traumatic experiences. And when I think of them as operational stress injuries, and whether it's physical injuries or psychological injuries, we know that when people develop sleep problems, or if they had sleep problems before these injuries, they're at higher risk not only of having chronic sleep problems, but of developing post-traumatic stress disorder, having chronic symptoms of traumatic brain injury, developing depression, being at higher risk for suicidality. But sleep is a modifiable risk factor. We can actually intervene with, as I said, without medication to reconsolidate sleep, retrain the brain to sleep the way it is designed to sleep. And that's falling asleep quickly, staying asleep, waking up rested, and having enough energy to accomplish all that needs to be done in one day. So it is slowly but surely changing, but there's certainly much more work that needs to be done.
You know, it's interesting. I come from a culture in the Marine Corps. I was an infantry officer, and you know, when something wouldn't be done, and somebody would look at you, and they would say, and you would ask them, why didn't this get done? And they would say, I didn't have time to do it. And the first response is, did you sleep last night? Well, I sort of did. Then you had time, because sleep isn't necessary, right? And what we do is necessary. How we are the custodian of other people's lives is necessary. Sleep is not. So if your sleep suffers, that's your problem. So that's our institutional bias. And so it's interesting, given that we wouldn't somehow rather address it at some point. The other thing, though, Ann, I want to ask you is a personal favor. I go around the country doing a thing called post-traumatic winning. Mm-hmm. And it deals with life after trauma enters, whether you got it in combat or whether you got beaten as a child or whatnot. And I say, look, trauma will certainly, right, enter your life at some point. Nobody gets out unscathed. And if you know these things about trauma, I sound like you, if you know these things about trauma, substitute sleep, not only can you live a good life, you can live a great life. And you can also share these things. So I'd like to talk to you about including your name and maybe a slide about what you do in the presentation I'll do. I'll go do it next week or at the Air Force Academy. I'll do it at Camp Pendleton with Marines, and then I'll go to the East Coast to do it for Marines of the 2nd Marine Division and some Army guys that are coming up. So I'd love to talk to you at a different point about that, about sharing your work. And I know you're getting a fair amount of media attention right now, but we are so desperate. Because like I said, I mean, I saw that article and I immediately seized on it because it impacts my life on a daily basis. And it impacts the lives of all my friends on a daily basis. So maybe we could be partners.
That would be an honor. The more there is, and as you said, you know, there's no class on this. There's not a lot. There's still a lot of work to be done in raising awareness, not just in changing the culture that sleep is a waste of time, but to one where the importance of sleep is recognized and paid attention. So anything I can support to raise this awareness, and importantly to let people know that just like post-traumatic stress disorder, that there are, it's manageable. It's, and in the case of sleep disturbances, for 80% of people, it's actually curable. We can train and teach people to sleep in a way that is not just healthy, but that is restorative. It's an achievable goal. And if we can not just raise awareness in the importance of sleep, especially in supporting post-traumatic growth and winning, that there's definitely, I'm biased, but convinced that it is that sleep is an important part of winning, generally speaking.
I love
but
that.
Especially in the context of trauma.
You're a quick learner too. You're winning there three times. But but I say the same things, is that not only, you know, trauma's awful, you know, and my sister had both of her sons murdered in a domestic violence incident. Now, I've been to Iraq and Afghanistan for 3 years. I'm not in my sister's zip code, you know, and we're lucky if we're veterans and we get it, because, you know, you can get paid for it by the government for the rest of your life. You have therapists chasing you to treat you from the VA and the DOD. And when you go to a Pirates game, people will stand up and applaud you. You know, there's other people in this country that don't. Mm-hmm. My sister doesn't get any of that. And so I tell the people that I speak to, it's like, hey, you need to solve two problems here. One is ignorance, and we just don't get educated about trauma, like we don't get educated about sleep. And the second one is isolation. You know, you think you're unique and that you're nobody could understand, but guess what? All that's wrong. And if you learn about it, and then you'll take these truths, and if you'll share them with other people, and you'll transform their lives, guess whose life gets transformed? And you begin to live a life that you have no idea. So I'm not here to tell you to lick your wounds and be okay. I'm telling you that you need to do that, and then you need to help us touch the lives of other people, change our community, change the nation, and so that people know that we as veterans who have a special place in this country have so much more to give, and we're not victims. We can do anything. And so your message is very much the same, and if you can't tell, I'm moderately motivated about it.
Yeah, well, I'm absolutely 100% on board. And to the point of isolation, it's true. I see the same pattern with people who have sleep difficulties, and they try to cope with it in different ways, and they try different pseudo-treatments, their approach that are pitched as, oh, if you do this, your sleep will get better. And unfortunately, oftentimes those treatments are not real treatments. They might be helpful for somebody who has very mild problem that happens once in a while, but people have like a nightly or most nights have problems with sleep, with insomnia or with nightmares or other kinds of sleep disorders. They try, but they oftentimes the doctors don't even know that there are specific treatments for insomnia or other sleep disorders. And this feeling of isolation is very common to say, I've tried all these things and nothing worked. I think it's really important for people to become more educated about sleep and about the kind of treatments and coping strategies that are effective, and to be able to differentiate these from other kinds of suggestions that make sense but don't have any scientific basis to treat sleep problems. So that's very, very similar. And in my work at the university, I had the privilege of working with service members and veterans, most of whom had post-traumatic stress reactions, oftentimes chronic. And I see the same kind of effort to seek treatments, to get better, to adopt new behaviors, to cope with it, but the kind of recommendation or suggestions that they get seems like they make sense, but they're not super effective, and unfortunately it leads people to become isolated, to stop seeking treatment because they think they've tried things that work and it didn't work for them.
That's exactly what we do. And if we don't hit it off with the doctor, rather than going back to the doctor and say, hey, Ann, like the last thing you told me didn't work. Okay.
Yeah.
Can you kind of up your game a little bit and help me here? Rather than having that discussion, we just say, I'm not going back.
Yes. I'm not going or taking the prescription and saying like, well, but I'm not going to use it.
And let me tell you, that's exactly I don't think we're very good patients. You know, because what things I talk about those two things relative to therapists. If you have the right to see somebody who's going to help you, and if for whatever reason you don't get along, put your hand up and say that. I see somebody else? You know, but do not stop going. And medication, right? And I tell people relative to trauma, you cannot medicate yourself to a good place, right? And you can't talk people being blown up and all the horrible experiences that one has in combat, or whether it's just living life like my sister has. You can't talk that place to a good thing. But both medication and talk therapy can be part of getting you to a good place. And you can't quit. You can't just go isolate yourself, because isolation is the first step down the path that leads to very destructive behavior. And so we fight those things. But again, I think that message pretty powerful when it comes from other veterans. When it comes from, you know, kind of geeky people that aren't part of our culture, we just dismiss it, right? Even if they are from Montreal. And so there's a cultural barrier that you're kind of trying to be a credible presence in this warrior culture, but I don't come from your culture. Mm-hmm. You know, you haven't even said the F word once, so I'm really not sure if we can trust you or accept you. So
neither of you, so I haven't. I'm waiting for you to drop it. That's good to know.
I'm on my best behavior right now. So if I was in my natural state, so do you know what I mean? So you fight all those barriers into this, and then we in turn, like I said, I mean, I was sitting here thinking while you were talking earlier, like, how could it be that I've never had a class on sleep, on, hey, do these things, especially in combat? Like, because there's people all the time that aren't sleeping on, you know, and then you got to go out. And I'll tell you this, I had a great experience when, in 2004, I went to Iraq, and I was on the staff of the 1st Marine Division, and General Mattis was the commanding general. John Kelly was the assistant division commander. He was just the chief of staff of the White House. And the current chief of staff, the current chairman of the Joint Chief, Joe Dunford, he was the chief of staff. So those three in the same small room, like, yeah, don't show up and be stupid at a meeting because General Mattis didn't suffer well. But one of the things I learned from all three of them, they were extremely disciplined about the personal habits to include sleep. Mm-hmm. And I remember General Mattis, I asked him once about it because he would leave every night at about 9 o'clock, leave his office and go to his little bungalow where he lived. And he would be in every day at about 5:20. And I said, so you have pretty structured. And he said, Mac, my, the number one weapon I use in this fight is my brain. And if I don't tend to it, right, and I make a mistake, I'm going to have to live with that for the rest of my life. And, you know, John Kelly told me the same thing. And, Colonel Dunford said, I don't have the luxury those two have because I have to wait till they leave before I can. So, but as soon as the last one leaves, I'm 30 seconds behind them. And so it's very interesting, guys who made weighty decisions and have been pretty good at it, to, you know, not to the point where they're at times were running parts of the free world, it seemed like. Yeah. They were extremely aware of their sleep pattern, the requirement, if you're going to make life and death decisions, to do it. And so it just seems like if you know that, I mean, shouldn't somebody have given us a class on that? It just seems ridiculous. You don't have to agree with that. That's just an observation on my part. But, I mean, the fight you must fight, you walk in and go, I can't believe how stupid these people are. Sleep's so essential to what they do, and they're not doing it, and you think that's going to lead to good outcomes?
Well, I don't think they're stupid. I think they have a lot of things to consider, many more than I can think of myself, and that sleep is the one thing I think about all the time, and they think of a million other different things. So sleep is not necessarily on the top of their list. However, you know, getting back to the General Mattis's point that the weapon is his brain, and the maintenance of that weapon, sleep is important in the maintenance of brain function and brain health, and therefore is how efficient and effective the weapon is, or who operates any kind of weapons, really. So I really appreciate that analogy. And you're right, too. You know, when you see, I think it needs to come from the top, too, that when you see leadership having behaviors and the discipline that includes protecting hours for sleep, regardless of the circumstances or as much as possible under even extreme circumstances, that this goes a long way to start conveying the message. However, to your point, the message needs to be explicit. If you don't tell people, look, it's important that you sleep because that's how you're going to perform the best, right, then people are not going to do this. And there's a million of other things that people could do instead of sleeping. So there's definitely a lot of work to do in that area. But as I said, slowly but surely, things are changing. And, you know, even doctors, I mean, to be fair, there are very few doctors that have any kind of education, formal education on sleep medicine. They hear about it maybe a couple of hours during their medical training. Some of them, very few, will specialize in sleep medicine, and there are very few people in sleep clinics. There are very few sleep clinics. So it's not necessarily as opposed to like cardiovascular health or diabetes or orthopedic surgery. So other things that also relate to performance. So there's few doctors that have the training. So when you go to your doctor and you say, I don't sleep well, their first reaction may be to say, I'll write a prescription. And don't get me wrong, there are some effective medications for insomnia, for example, or for nightmares. They work for some people. We're not very good at predicting who's going to respond well to one medication or another. But they wouldn't, oftentimes they don't even know that there are non-medication options that are available. So that covers the whole, I think, from the operational side in the field all the way to once you're in your doctor's office and you say, hey, I have a sleep problem. They tell you what they know, but they don't necessarily know that there are non-medication options to sleep, to treat sleep disorders.
Got it. Why am I hearing myself? Okay, never mind. I don't know what happened right there. I've got an email for you. Mac, Anne's credibility just went through the roof when she said, I'm waiting for you to say it first, so stop giving her such a tough time. So your credibility has been established, Anne. Congratulations. Talk to us.
Thank you.
Again, my guest is Dr. Anne Germain. She is the founder and CEO of a company called, how do you say that? Noctem?
Noctem.
Okay, Noctem. And they recently been awarded a contract or a grant by the DOD to study sleep. So, and talk to us about what did you do to get their attention, and tell us about the study, and then tell us where this is all heading.
So, with great pleasure. So, how did I get their attention? So, I'm a sleep geek, as you said. So, I've been in sleep for a long time. I came to Pittsburgh in October 2001, right after 9/11, and just the timing, I and my expertise was already in sleep and post-traumatic stress disorder. So built my research program, basically extended my research program to start working with service members going and coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq at the time, looking specifically at their sleep, because being a sleep geek, I'm completely biased and thought that, you know, if we have sleep-specific treatments, we can help people with post-traumatic stress disorder and people without PTSD who have sleep problems, and that we didn't know much about the brain circuitry that contributes to post-traumatic stress disorder or contributes to sleep disturbances. And I thought it was really my duty to do this kind of research. There are many people that were doing that research too now, more so than at the time, but try to understand what contributes to sleep disturbances and, more importantly, how do we treat them. Being an academia researcher, you submit grant proposal, and I've been very fortunate to be successful in securing grants that allowed us to look at the brains in sleeping, look at the sleeping brain, and understand what kind of sleep disturbances or what was unique about sleep disturbances and post-traumatic stress disorder, and also to develop and test and adapt sleep treatment in the way that made sense for military service members and veterans. Trying to understand the culture, but also framing it in a way that makes sense and building on the training that people already have, and that is a strength that we hadn't leveraged, I think, to the extent that we could do this. So that kind of research is one of the ways that we got their attention. But then at the same time, as I said, the military has, the Air Force has been aware of the importance of sleep for a very long time. So as the Army, the Navy as well, there's a number of accidents that have happened that have been attributed to fatigue, and that really means because people work these unusual and extremely difficult watch bills, and that contribute to not sleeping well, making poor decisions or slow reactions, and then accidents. So overall, across the different branches, there was this growing awareness that, hey, sleep is something that we haven't paid attention to, but it is something that we can modify. It's something that if we start paying attention to and maybe changing our behaviors around sleep, we may have outcomes, the results that we're looking for in terms of decreasing injuries or accidents or preventing mishaps, even. So that's kind of the larger picture that happened at the same time. People coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, a lot of people come from sleep problems.
Hello.
Yes.
No, that's me.
Okay.
I mean, I was never a great sleeper, right? My mom. Could you sleep a long time? Can you?
Me personally?
Yes, you personally.
Yes, after working a few night shifts, I can sleep 9 hours.
Wow. So I was never a great sleeper. I mean, I was always an early riser. But I never had the issues that, you know, not being able to sleep through the night consistently, mm-hmm. waking up multiple times every night, you know. And so people are surprised, like, well, you don't sleep through the night? And, like, my friends and I, we laugh, right? No. And they're like, well, how many times do you wake up? Like, once? Or like, no, maybe 3 or 4 times, sometimes more. And, well, what do you do? I don't know. I just lay there till I go back to sleep. And then I get up. And and they say every night? Yeah, pretty much. If I sleep through the night, I wake up and go, holy shit, I think I just slept through the night. I'm not sure because I don't really remember what that feels like, but I think I just did. I think that's, you know, again, all my friends, we're all like that.
Yeah, and I think that's my hypothesis, and I don't know that there's any kind of scientific data to back it up, but I think that when people sign up to serve in the military, boot camp or the initial training is very good at screening people who are able to tolerate severe sleep disruption and sleep restriction, so that the people that make it through and have a career or serve for 3 years or more actually have this built-in capacity to tolerate very little sleep or very disrupted sleep, which can be very helpful under extreme circumstances, but not so much when you're back home and it's kind of the day-to-day life without extreme stressors or unusual environments around you. So this resistance is something that is, and this resilience, this capability, this capacity to function even with such disrupted sleep is quite impressive. And I'm always amazed the stories that I hear that people sleep very little and yet they're very productive. They have families, they work, they're involved, they volunteer. And I'm thinking, like, wow, I don't know that many people outside of military service members and veterans who could tolerate this, and emergency workers, of course, first responders.
Ours becomes a way of life, right? I mean, that's just, we don't even question it anymore.
But the downside, like, the sad part to it is that it does take its toll. Even if people are able to tolerate it and function, it does have an impact on their brain, like their mood and just physical health as well. We know that people with insomnia or poor sleep are more likely to have diabetes or hypertension or other kinds of chronic medical condition. And again, sleep is a modifiable risk factor for these. We can treat sleep. And that's how that's basically this project that we're starting soon in the fall is actually that what we've done is trying to bridge this gap, using technology to bridge the gap. We know doctors don't necessarily know about sleep treatments, or even when they do know, they don't have the capacity to provide the behavioral treatments, the treatments that don't require medication for insomnia. And we know that more and more people, patients, know about them, but they don't know where to find them. And when they do get them, the traditional treatment would mean that you would have to go to the clinic, see a therapist or your doctor for typically 5 to 8 weeks at 45 minutes each time in a face-to-face or via telehealth or telemedicine via video conference. Now, that is a lot of time, and it's kind of burdensome. It's very burdensome, actually. What we've developed is basically we've used what we know works in behavioral sleep medicine, combined that with digital technologies to create a platform that is both for providers and for patients so that they can all have access to the first line recommended treatments for sleep disorders directly into their hands. And since doctors have generally have little sleep education, what we've developed is we use machine learning algorithms and artificial intelligence to help physicians or providers and clinicians to make the right decision based on what patients say. So what we have basically is people get an app, and their providers is connected to that app, and the app doesn't work in itself. You have to work with a provider to be able to activate the app. But the provider, even if they have less experience in sleep medicine, they can make sense of the information that people provide through the app, because our algorithms do a lot of the heavy lifting, if you want, in interpreting this information about their sleep and then in providing recommendations of what kind of technique should be recommended for this particular person to help them sleep better. Provider can approve as is or make some modification to these recommendations, but what we provide is a way to assist the clinicians in their decision making, so that we can have a much larger number of clinicians who know about effective sleep treatments, but can also provide them with a high level of integrity, so knowing that they can provide the intervention the way it is meant to be delivered, and for patients to receive it the way, in a way that we know is most efficient and where they're most likely to benefit from it.
So your app is designed for the physician more than the consumer?
Actually, it is designed for the providers and their patients. And but when we designed it, we worked directly with service members and veterans that were coming through our studies at the University of Pittsburgh, and getting their feedback and their comments on, like, the app for the end user app that we have. So one of the things that I've always said is great with working with military people is that the feedback that they give is always very direct, very candid. They don't sugar wrap it. And well, it's way more efficient that way. So we basically worked with them to say, look, we're developing this at the time when I was at the university, saying, like, look, we're developing this app. This is what we want to do. What does it look like? What do you need to know? How do you want to see it? What is it that you don't want to see on your app? How does it need to function? So we really worked with a group of people to get their feedback and then made the changes that they recommended, gave it back to them and say, okay, what do you think now? And we did that several times, actually, until people said, all right, now it makes sense to me. Now I can use it. Now I understand what you're asking and willing to do it.
Okay, so could you explain how it works? So I have this thing on my phone. I can't sleep. What do I do?
You do is in the morning and in the evening. So when you get out of bed in the morning, the app will ask you a few questions about your sleep the night before.
Right.
And in the evening, the same thing. The app will ask you a few questions about different kinds of behaviors or health habits during the day. So things about caffeine or stimulants you use during the day. Did you drink alcohol? Did you take a nap? Do you smoke? Things that we know affect the brain's level of activation at bedtime. And we ask people to do that for a few days in a row, usually a week or so. And that allows us to have really good picture, if you want, of somebody's sleep profile over time, something that is very accurate for each individual. And based on this, our algorithms will detect what kind of sleep disordered pattern is experienced by the person. And now for some of them, it's not super high level machine learning there. We just ask people, for example, do you have nightmares? And if they say yes, we'll recommend a treatment for nightmares. Again, non-medication treatment for nightmares, a technique to get rid of those. So usually people will fill out the morning and the evening portion of a sleep log for about a week. And after a week, we have pretty high confidence and a really pretty high accuracy to say which technique should be recommended to this particular person to achieve the level of sleep quality that is restorative and consolidated, meaning you fall asleep, you stay asleep, and you feel refreshed when you wake up. The morning part of the diary or the sleep log takes less than about a minute and a half to complete, and the evening section is about 57 seconds to complete. So it's short enough that once people get the hang of it, they complete it pretty much every day. The other thing I should say is that, yes, the information is shared with the provider, the clinician, the therapist at the end, the other end of the line, if you want. But there's also a text messaging system that is embedded in the app, so that you know, if somebody misses a few entries, their clinician will send them a reminder pretty quickly, and we can set alarms on people's phone to help them to remember to do this. But usually within 2 or 3 days, people get in the habit of filling out the questionnaire or the morning logs and the evening logs, and very quickly then we can basically provide them with the kind of recommendations of the specific techniques that will help them. And when I say that, it means that people on their phone will see a module appear in the app that wasn't there before, and it will tell people what to do, which technique to do, how to do it, and why we're asking them to do it as it relates to what we know about the biology of sleep. But to be honest with you, very few people get to the why. They just want to know what to do and how to do it. And that's good enough. As long as they do it, it will work for almost 80% of the people will see changes in their sleep within a week. And usually within 4 to 5 weeks, people can fall asleep quickly and stay asleep throughout the night.
And that is because of the data that their provider has, and then the algorithms that you all have written that analyze that data and then recommend, steer the provider, who may have a varying degree of understanding of insomnia, into a towards a better outcome.
That this is exactly it.
Do you want to hire me or what? I have two emails for you. One, Mac, I have a question relative to sleep. Before I go to sleep, should I kind of dial it down for an hour or a given period of time before I try to sleep? Because normally what I do, and I am a veteran of the Iraq War, I get tired and I go to bed. There's no transition or me getting ready to go to sleep. I just feel a little bit drowsy and I'll go to bed, and I hope that I can stay asleep for as long as I can stay asleep. Is there a better way, Anne?
Nope. If you go to sleep when you feel sleepy and you fall asleep within 30 minutes, then it means that the winding down has already happened before you felt sleepy, and that you're sleepy enough to be able to fall asleep quickly.
Got it.
It's working. Don't change it.
All right. Next email. Mac, first of all, thanks for having Ann on. I've never heard a segment about sleep on anything I've ever listened to, so thank you very much. My question is, how do I get my provider to investigate Ann's work and therefore be able to help me better?
There are a number of resources, both for consumers, people who are looking for the information, and for providers. I would, not knowing in which geographical region the person is, I would say one source that is a good source for referrals and information for both patients and for providers is the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. I believe it's AASM.org. That is the National Association for Sleep Medicine in the U.S. There's also the Society for Behavioral Sleep Medicine, SBSM, that has resources, and those are specifically for treatments that do not involve medication. That's what we mean by behavioral treatment or behavioral medicine. So the AASM, American Academy of Sleep Medicine, and the SBSM, Society for Behavioral Sleep Medicine, are two of the main resources that anyone can consult. And from there, they too have other kinds of links that are available for more regional or local resources.
Okay. Or they could just give them your website and say, you know, you should check this out.
They can send me an email, let me know which area they're in, and I will make sure that I will do my best to find a resource close by that they can consult with.
Awesome. All right. And first of all, you've been very gracious with your time. A final question for you. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you that you want people to know about what you're doing if they have a problem with sleep? Because as you said, you know, we all like to pretend. We like to fake that it doesn't affect our lives and we just continue to power through this sleep issue. But the bottom line is that I think all of us know deep down that it does affect our lives, it affects our health, and that's certainly a concern given all the other things that people that have fought in conflicts have relative to their physical health. So what haven't I been smart enough to ask you about that you want people to know?
Actually, the main points that I want to get across, you've already asked me the question, but I'll just reiterate them now. The fact that, you know, sleep is critical for mental and physical health. And that is one aspect that we can influence with our daytime behaviors, with our behaviors very quickly and see the results quickly. So I always compare it to a diet. You know, if you want to go on the diet to lose weight, it'll take several weeks before you see a noticeable difference. But with sleep, it doesn't take very long. Within a week or two, you can notice very significant difference. And within a month or 6 weeks, fall asleep quickly, stay asleep, and be rested and have all the energy needed to go about the day. So that sleep is important. The discipline about sleep that you mentioned earlier, I think this is critical. And the other point that is essential is that when people have sleep problems, that there are effective treatments. We all sleep, but the treatments can oftentimes all be adjusted to meet each individual's particular sleep needs. Don't give up. Contact me or look at the resources that I've mentioned earlier. There are effective sleep treatments, and it is achievable to fall asleep and stay asleep and feel rested. So if there's anything I can do to support this, I'm happy to be a resource for people and send them the information. There's no reason for not sleeping and for continuing this resistance over time. I would say save the energy for when it's really needed, and the rest of the time people have earned their restful sleep.
Her name is Dr. Ann Germain, and she's been gracious enough to come on and talk about her company and what they're doing. So, and tell everybody where they can find your website, and they can, if you have questions, I'm sure you can ask Ann via the website. So can you give them that information?
The website is Noctem Health. It's Noctem, as in Mary, health.com. And if you use the send a comment or reach us, the email will come directly to my team and I, and we will make sure to get back to you as quickly as we can to get the information and sources of information that people are looking for.
All right. And I was serious. I will include your information in my presentations, because, you know, one of the things I saw, really interesting things that something that, you know, and I use it kind of talking about trauma. And it's two Indian mental health providers who did a study about depression, and they were doing it in Texas. They wrote software program. And what they did was they said, you know, in the study, the general practitioner screened for depression at every visit. And if you show symptoms three consecutive times or three times, then that gets addressed at every office visit, right? So they said, we are genuinely trying to do preemptive medicine. And he said, you know, out of the 44,000, we had between 12 and 15 percent of the people that showed, you know, early signs of symptoms of depression. And then he kind of muses and he said, but out of that, we only had 1%, less than 1%, that ultimately saw a psychiatrist. Mm. And so what would a general practitioner talk to somebody who's suffering from depression? And they talked about diet, sleep, exercise, disclosure, right, talking about it. And what, diet, sleep, exercise, disclosure, and something else.
Nutrition?
Nutrition. There's one more, but I can't remember. But, you know, and so how important that sleep is in a component. And I look at people and say, look, you know, I would tell you that you could draw the same parallel with trauma. right?
Yeah.
The majority of us are just struggling because we don't know about it, right? And we can be a mentor for somebody else, and sleep is certainly a huge component of that. So first of all, thank you, and I hope you don't mind. I'll include your stuff in what I do, and at some point I hope our paths cross in the future. And I just want to say thank you from a lot of people that hopefully will be the recipients of what you and your people do, who've done great things in the world. And God bless you for doing what you're doing, and thanks for coming on and doing this today.
Well, thank you. It's been an honor and a pleasure, and you know, our mission is to, you know, through sleep we can get to better health, and right, serving those who serve has been a true privilege. So thank you very much.
All right. I hope you don't mind in the future if I bug you and haul you back on.
Oh, no, please do. I'll be happy to join.
Okay. All right. There you have it. Thank you, Ann.
Thank you very much.
There you have it. How awesome is that? Ann Germain. And here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio. So there you have it. Noctem, Noctem. All right. She's the CEO and co-founder. and she got a good sense of humor, too. So, you know, and again, I know so many people that struggle sleeping. And, you know, this is the first time I've ever seen somebody doing something that's, you know, kind of revolutionary. That all of us can participate in. And as she said, look, check out, if you have an issue, check out the website. And again, the app is designed to be an interface between you and your physician. The algorithm in there is designed to support your physician, but it needs your data. So so that's how it works. But my thanks to Ann Germain and everybody at Noctem for what they do. Very, 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 very cool stuff. And obviously a fun guest. Here's an email. Mac, what a cool interview. What a wonderful person. She sounded like just somebody that all of us would like to get to know, but deeply committed to what she does. Well done. Well done. I haven't slept through the night since I got back from Vietnam. I don't know if it was just the vigilance at night, being scared, or some kind of mix of all of that. You would have thought in the intervening years that I would certainly have gotten around that. I have not. I will certainly recommend to my physician that they reach out and seek this software. I would love to be able to sleep through the night. I'm like you. When it happens, on the rare occasion that it does, I'm amazed. And I actually chuckle to myself when it does happen, because it's not very often. Yeah, I think there's a whole lot of people that are certainly in that boat. That'll do it. Sleep, the subject of the program today. No, it's, I mean, pretty important part of your life, whether you're dealing with trauma, whether you're just dealing with your health. And you know when Ann talked about all the different parts of your health that sleep impacts, and I think most of us have lived in a culture where sleep is not considered to be a priority. And I'm not joking. In the Marine Corps, you know, you'll get looked at and, you know, you'll get asked, did you sleep last night? Yeah, I did. Well, then you had time to do it. Sleep isn't a requirement. It's a luxury. So, no, I mean, it's the way the culture works. And, you know, we can complain and bitch about it all we want, but it's not going to change anything. Not going to change anything. So getting good at sleep, pretty important. Here's another email. Mac, interesting little anecdote you threw out there about General Mattis, General Kelly, and Colonel Dunford. What a good lesson to learn. No, General Mattis really disciplined. And it's one thing, you know, I took away from, one of the many things that I took away from that year was you know, the level of discipline that they have built into their lives to be able to function under incredible pressure. And the issues are so complex, right? And there's all these little subtle, you know, there's all these little nuances that go with those issues that if you're not up to the task, you know, maybe it's more civilians that get killed, maybe it's money wasted, maybe it's, you know, Marines and sailors that get killed, and none of that's acceptable. And so, you know, you have to, and again, the intensity on a day-to-day basis, I think would blow people away. That's why I say when you come home, you know, you're mentally exhausted. You know, you can just lay down to sleep, lay down on your couch, you put your blue jeans on and a t-shirt or a sweatshirt, and you grab a pillow and you hop on your couch. I mean, you can stay there for days. And it's not physical exhaustion. It is the mental exhaustion of the intensity of everything you do. And so how do you reclaim that? How do you do that? So, again, my thanks to Dr. Ann Germain for coming on today. The company is NOCTEM, NOCTEM. So check it out. Maybe they can help you. All right. Talk about sleep in the first hour. And I tell you a little bit about Ann and her company. So very, very cool. Very, very cool. All right. That'll do it on a Wednesday. Kenny and Lynch. Lynch and Kenny here tomorrow. On Monday, Ronnie Reyes is going to join us. He is a Gold Star son, lost his father in Vietnam, and went back to Vietnam for, I believe, the second time. Went back on his own timeline, spending his own money, not part of a tour. And he said he had an incredible experience, and so he's going to come on and talk about that on Monday. General Zinni, I think they're making an appearance next week, talking about on discipline, which will be awesome. So looking forward to that. So have a great day on a Wednesday. All Marine Radio is over and out.